Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday and Sunday right here on KTEP. And joining us today is Steve Berry. Steve is the author of various novels. The recent one is The Lincoln Myth, and it's already at the top of the charts of the New York Times bestsellers list. And Steve has written several historical fiction books, The Jefferson Key, The Columbus Affair, The Emperor's Tomb. One of his main characters is Cotton Malone. Steve, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us to discuss your new novel.
Now, we're great to be here. It's great to be back.
First of all, everybody has different ideas about Abraham Lincoln. There have been a lot of what you want to call myths, stereotypes, and we tend to do that with heroes. What is the Lincoln myth?
Well, it's a variety of things. It's much more, it's very complex. There's a lot about him that was a myth, and one of the main ones that we explore in this novel is this concept of that Lincoln somehow saved the Union. Lincoln did not save the Union. Lincoln created the Union. He actually created the concept that the states are indivisible and that the states can never leave and that we are in this forever. Prior to Lincoln, no one actually believed that. The first 15 presidents of the United States would have said that was ridiculous. I mean, James Buchanan himself, before Lincoln, said that was ridiculous. So Lincoln created this. Now, the question is, was he right? Of course, the Civil War, you know, was fought, and we've accepted that since then. But there's an interesting constitutional question of whether or not he's actually correct. And this novel, this modern-day thriller with my hero, Cotton Malone, he gets caught up in exploring whether or not Lincoln was right.
In one of the, and Shelby Foote, the fact that he is an expert on the Civil War, he's written some huge volumes on the Civil War, and he said kind of what you did about the Union, that the Civil War, what it did was it changed the wording of from the United States is to United States are?
Yeah, basically we became an indivisible Union after the Civil War. Now, the Founding Fathers never believed that. That was never in their game plan, because here's what you'd have to believe. You'd have to believe that they fought the Revolutionary War, threw off the yoke of a king, then they went to Philadelphia and in secret and created a brand new yoke that they could never get rid of. That makes no sense. It's completely illogical. Instead, the Constitution is silent on the question of whether a state can leave the Union. Three states, Rhode Island, Virginia, and New York, reserved the right to walk away from the Union in their ratification votes, and no one objected to that reservation. So this concept that the Union is forever is not something the Founding Fathers ever envisioned. It's something Abraham Lincoln envisioned, and it's held over to this day.
It's interesting, at the beginning of the novel, actually even before the novel starts, you have a quote by President Lincoln, and if I may read it, it's January 12, 1848, and it says, "Any people anywhere, being inclined and having the power, have the right to rise up and shake off the existing government and form a new one that suits them better. This is a most valuable and most sacred right, a right which we hope and believe is to liberate the world. Nor is this right confined to cases in which the whole people of an existing government may choose to exercise it. Any portion of such people that can may revolutionize and make their own of so much of the territory as they inhabit." Abraham Lincoln, January 12, 1848.
That's a statement of secession is what that is. He's very clearly saying that if you don't agree with the government, you have the right to walk away from it and start your own. And he made that there's no other way to read that quote. Yet in 1861, 13 years later, he took the exact opposite position and said, no, a small group of people in the government has no right to walk away from it. The whole, a part of the government has no right to walk away from it. He took a completely opposite tack 13 years later.
And the Nebraska-Kansas Act had a big effect also on his view on slavery, and of course he didn't know there was going to be a civil war, but somebody anticipated that there was going to be a secession from some of the states.
Yeah, Lincoln opposed the spread of slavery. He clearly did that, and he was consistent on that along the way, that he opposed the spread of it. But he's not a great abolitionist. You don't hear a lot of Lincoln saying, let's end slavery. It's not something he talks about very much. And for good reason, probably, because it was not a subject matter that was overly political, to be honest with you, up until the Civil War itself. But the Civil War had little to do with slavery.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Constitution of the United States does sanction slavery.
Yes, it does. It's a perfectly legal institution that half the founding fathers owned slaves. It's clearly in there. It's sanctioned. The Three-Fifths Compromise makes a slave three-fifths of a person. It's all in there. And that's, the only way slavery could ever be ended was by a constitutional amendment, which eventually the 13th Amendment, which was ratified in December of 1865, did. But no president could end slavery. No person could do it. And so there's another myth of Lincoln. How many slaves did Lincoln free? He freed none. Absolutely zero.
And he even mentioned it in his inaugural address.
He said,
I have no power to free slaves.
I have no power to do that. The Emancipation Proclamation was a political gimmick. It was today, if he would have done that, he would have been filleted in the press and laid out on the 24-hour news cycle and laughed at. When he did it, it took on a different aura, but it had no legal authority. He only freed the slaves in the rebel territories, of which he had no control over. The slaves he actually could have freed in his control, that he actually could have tried to free in his control, he did. He exempted them from the Emancipation Proclamation. But even then, he didn't have the power to free them, because no president has that power. It was a law, and the only way to change that is through the legal process.
As you mentioned, President Lincoln championed the 13th Amendment, and Steven Spielberg's movie focuses on that.
Yes.
But however, there is still that myth that, as you mentioned, that with that 13th Amendment, he freed the slaves.
Yeah, the 13th Amendment happened, of course, after he was gone. But he did champion the amendment. He did work very hard to get it passed in Congress. But he knew that. He knew he had to do that. It was the only way he was going to end the institution. The Civil War, with the fact that the North won the war, did not end slavery. Slavery was still legal. It was still a constitutional institution. It still took a constitutional amendment to change it. That he did do, and that's part of his greatness, that he pushed that through.
Now, you have talked about, of course, the name of the book is The Lincoln Myth, and myths get started sometimes when people die young. They die early, and last year we commemorated the anniversary of the 50th year of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And President Kennedy was a student of Lincoln's. And I remember in one of the books I read where he asked the Lincoln historian, had President Lincoln not been killed, would he have been as great as people think about him today? And of course, the answer he said was no.
No, I don't think he would. I think dying the way he did added to that. But in the first 20 years after Lincoln was killed, he was vilified. Nobody talked of Abraham Lincoln in any way of respect or honor. He was very poorly liked. It started around the turn of the 20th century is when the myth began, and then by the mid-20th century it was in place, and now it's just sainthood. He's just gone up to the level of sainthood. And I'm not trying to diminish Lincoln. In fact, the truth about Lincoln makes him even greater than the myth does. And he had a tough job, and he did it, and we're here today thanks to him. But it doesn't mean, it doesn't mean that we have to create all this fiction about somebody. Why don't we look at it from a realistic standpoint? And to me, it's very interesting. And this novel explores all of that in great detail.
Steve, does that apply, would you say, to President Kennedy?
Same thing, yes. I mean, Kennedy, when he was president, I mean, he was having a tough time. It was questionable whether he could even get reelected a second time. It was going to be a tough fight in 64. And he knew that. He knew he had a tough fight coming. He was not the most popular president. He was not the most effective president. But dying in the tragic way that he did, yes, it brings you into myth. And, of course, now we know about a lot of things about Kennedy that were basically kept hidden at that time. And dying young does, and dying tragically, does begin to create, we have a tendency to create those myths, yes.
You mentioned another president in your novel, and that is President Madison. Tell us about this.
James Madison is interesting because it's Madison's notes that we go by, the notes from the Constitutional Convention. He kept the notes, and those notes are basically like minutes. and they're published. There's a big, thick volume of them, and any court who ever wants to know what did the Founding Fathers talk about when they were writing the Constitution, they go to Madison's notes. But here's the problem with those notes. They weren't published until 53 years after the convention. Madison, during that time, freely admits openly that he changed, modified, and edited the notes to make them more readable. And then he left specific instructions that the notes were never to be published until himself and everyone to the convention was dead. So he basically didn't want anyone alive who could contradict what he wrote. So we literally have no idea what happened at the Constitutional Convention. We only know what Madison told us happened. Now, his notes are completely silent on the question of secession. It's never mentioned anywhere in there. But we're not sure if they discussed it or not, since Madison edited those notes. And I never knew all of this till I started the research on this book and realizing just how little we do know about the actual creation of the Constitution.
One of the things that we know and we talk about and sometimes it gets involved in, and that's the separation of church and state, when people mention religion, anything like that. And as far as we know, President Lincoln was the first president to read the Book of Mormon, I think.
Yes.
And you mention the Church of Latter-day Saints in your book and their involvement in our history.
Yes, this book deals with that. There was a secret deal made between Lincoln and the Mormons in January of 1863 that altered the course of the Civil War, and it's real. I didn't make that up. And I came across this a couple of years ago, and I realized there was a novel in there. The Mormon Church has a very unique role in American history. They've been around at some very key points in our history, and this book explores a lot of that. The Mormon faith is a quintessential American religion. It was created here, formulated here. It's the only religion that I know of where the Constitution of the United States is actually part of their doctrine. And they were in a very unique position in 1863, and Lincoln cut a deal with them, a very significant deal. And you're right, Lincoln was the first president we know of who read the Book of Mormon. He checked it out of the Library of Congress in July of 1862. I actually went there and held that book. It's still there, and you can go and see it. It's there for display. And this book doesn't deal with Mormon religion much, but it does deal with Mormon history and how they figured into our American history and what their role has been. It's very interesting, and it was a lot of fun to explore it, and I think the reader's going to get a new appreciation and understanding for that.
In talking about American history, we hear now that we're not as patriotic as we used to be, as Tom Brokaw wrote in The Greatest Generation. In fact, Burns, when he did his World War II documentary, we see the people who are very patriotic and welcoming the troops after the war, etc. And some people now say that we don't have as much patriotism as we should. And in your novel, your hero, Cotton Malone, gets involved because of a threat to the integrity of our country.
Yes, he does. And I think we do have patriotism. I think it's out there. It's just in a different today. I mean, we don't wear it around quite so openly. But, you scratch America, you hurt America, and you'll see how they'll rise up. You don't want to mess with them. You don't want to mess with America. And it's there. It's very much there. And it's strong. And I think, Cotton, of course, is very much drawn by this and very much motivated by all of that. And I deal with that. I deal with patriotism. The next year's book is actually called The Patriot Threat. And I deal with this quite a bit because I think it is strong in America right now. But I also think that there's divisions in this country. We also are a bit polarized. And that's a problem that we're going to learn to deal with. But I think it's just a problem as we become more informed and more active and more involved, you get more opinions, and more opinions mean more polarization.
Why is it that, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, that you've written books, The Jefferson Key, The Columbus Affair, you tend to bring your protagonists in dealing with events that happened hundreds of years ago and then bring them to present time and the crisis that's going on at the current time?
Yes, I always do something from the past, something lost, something forgotten, something you may not know a lot about but want to know more about. And I find that thing, and I call that kind of my ooh thing, the thing that kind of makes you go ooh. And in this case, it deals with Lincoln, who's kind of an ooh word. But then I have to make it so what? It still has to be relevant today. And in this case, I had a little tweak. I just made a little tweak to something from history back then that makes it still relevant today so Cotton can get involved in that. And I have to have both of those connections, that ooh factor and that so what, to make the novel work. You know, you don't want to, the fact is something cool, you know, who cares if the Mormons and Lincoln made a deal in 1863? That's a long time ago. Well, with a little tweak, you still care today. It has a lot to do with today. And that's what makes the thriller a thriller, because my primary goal for writing these books is to entertain. And if I can inform and get you stimulated in the process, that's great. But my main job is to entertain you.
Because you write about history, is there a favorite time of history that, you know, one of the times that I guess you have, I'm not sure because I haven't read all your books, I've read most of them, but that is the Old West and also the era like Prohibition.
Yeah, I used to would answer your question, what's my favorite time? I'd say the Middle Ages, but I wouldn't say that today because I've done ancient books with Alexandria Link and with Venetian betrayal, and then I've done China with the Emperor's Tomb. I've done American history, European. I really kind of like it all. I don't really have a favorite any longer. And you're right, some more aspects of next year's book deals a little bit with early 20th century America, yes.
Talking about history, a lot of people say, you know, our students, our young people don't know history. They don't read like they used to. And social media has changed a lot of that, because if you go on whether it be Facebook or some other page, sometimes they'll read something and it's not cited correctly or it doesn't have a source, and people think that. And as we're talking about President Lincoln, I have a friend who teaches middle school here, and he told me that he was talking to his students about Lincoln and that one of the students said, "Mister, you forgot to tell us that also he was a vampire slayer."
It is a shame that history has taken on an aura of being boring and dull, and I don't want to know anything about that. And it is a problem. And some of it's the way we teach it, because we teach it in a way that's not very exciting. So, you know, it's more about story. It's all about story. If you can tell it as a story, I think people would get interested more in it, and you tell it in the context of how it all fits together. It's an exciting story in a lot of ways. So we probably have to rethink how we teach it. But you're exactly right. There's a lot of bad information. People go to the internet. They go to Wikipedia, which is, you know, Wikipedia is just you and me.
Yes.
You know, putting information
self-edited.
Down.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, none of that means it's relevant. You got to get the right information, the correct information, to understand it. And it is difficult in today's world because we want information instantly. We want instantaneous gratification. History requires a little more reading and a little more context. But I'm hopeful that novels like mine and others who write books like we do that can get people excited enough to go and look things up and to study it and to get interested in it. That's one of the goals that I set out for.
You're right about stories and the fact that history is basically a story. That's why it's called history. And the fact that you talk about making it interesting, if you were, and you're a writer and a storyteller, if you were a history teacher, how would you teach history, Steve?
I would teach it in story form. Absolutely. I would teach it in a way in which I could set up a story and take them through it. Now, unfortunately, there's a few facts and figures you do have to pick up, but I would try to teach it that way where I could get people, you know, engaged in it. I spoke to the Tennessee educators a few years ago, the history teachers all across Tennessee, and we discussed this for an afternoon about this concept of teaching as story. And they all agreed with me it's the best way to do it. It would require some new textbooks and some new ways of putting things together, but I think that's the way that you're going to get people engaged, is a story. Particularly the teacher leads that story and keeps that story moving forward, where each day the students are interested in finding out what happened next. What happened next? Tell me what happened next. Instead of, oh God, we're going to hear another series of dates and names and stuff that means nothing to me. It also would be good to engage them if they could see it. They can see it and touch it and experience it. And today with the internet being available, you can visit just about every historic place in the world. And it gives them a way to become engaged.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Again, as you mentioned, you know, we can go to the internet and search and do different research. And I love history, so I'm always looking for different things. And It seems like I read somewhere that in ancient China, each time a new emperor took over, that he would talk about the preceding dynasty.
Yeah, what would happen in China, it's horrible. The new emperor would take over, and he would purge everything from that happened before him. He would purge all the books, all the records, everything. It was as if nothing happened before him. And they kept this up for so many centuries that eventually China just forgot their history. They literally forgot what they had invented and what they did. It was in the 19th century that a British fellow who went over there and lived in China, he wrote a series of books, almost an encyclopedia, that reacquainted the Chinese with their own history. And that just gives you an example of what happens when you do something like that. You completely forget who you are and where you came from.
Now, as far as China goes and history in general, you mentioned the fact that we have to make it interesting. And sometimes I think it's the way it's taught and it's also the way it's written when you combine history and fiction and make it exciting like this. Is it difficult to do that? I mean, you still have to do the research because you have to get the dates right. But what about these plots that you come up with, Steve, where you talk about history and then modern times?
That's the whole point. That's what I want to do. I want to put those two together and merge them together to show that there's that connection, that history is not this obscure thing that happened long ago that nobody cares about anymore and is meaningless. It actually still has great relevance today. And every one of the historical elements that I've used in all my novels, I've tied back in today. You know, like, who cares if we find the Library of Alexandria? Well, I made it where we care today, or the Tomb of Alexander the Great, or Charlemagne's records, or what Napoleon left behind. All of these things are in the novels, and I make them relevant. And that's the kind of thing that I think gets people interested when they go, well, wow, that happened all that long ago. But, yeah, look, this could change everything right now. That's what brings history alive with people. And I think that's what people find from novels like mine when they get that connection of, you know, they make that connection and say, wow, it actually does still matter today. And I think that's what we need to do with our kids in the schools, too.
I think when we have channels like the History Channel and documentaries talking about history, it makes it a little bit more interesting. And when people actually see artifacts of historical value, they go, wow, that's interesting. Or oral history, you know, grandparents passing on stories to their loved ones. And I saw a great movie over Memorial Day called Memorial Day, and it's a grandfather telling his grandson about World War II. But what people don't know, my point is the fact that you and your wife, you love history so much that since, I guess, 4 years ago, you and your wife, Elizabeth, have traveled the country and you've saved endangered historic treasures.
We have. Our History Matters Foundation has helped out all across the country in raising money for historic preservation. We just completed our book tour, and we just did three events on the book tour. We did an event for the Edgar Allan Poe House in Baltimore, the James Thurber House in Columbus, Ohio, and then for the Art Legacy League in the Quad Cities area. And we raised several thousand dollars for all of these events that will go to help preserve these historical legacies. We've done this all over the country, and we've got some more coming up. We're going to do our first one in Canada in all August. And we've raised about $750,000 for historic projects around the country. And if anybody out there has a project they think we could help out with, they can go to my website, steveberry.org, the History Matters section, and send us an email, and we'll see if we can come and help you out.
And how does the program work, Steve?
They send us an email. We take a look at it. We get in touch with them, and then we set up an event. We don't give money to organizations. We help local organizations raise money. And like we did in Baltimore, we did a meet and greet in which people paid to come, and then I did a talk, and people paid to come see that, and all of that money went to the Poe House. Same with the Thurber House, but we taught a writer's workshop there where Elizabeth and I taught for 4 hours. We've taught about 2,600 students around the country, and all of the money from that workshop went to the Thurber House. Elizabeth and I don't charge to come. We don't charge expenses. We pay our own way. So we basically work with the local entity, whatever works in your community, where you can use us to raise money from.
Well, if you want to come visit us, we're celebrating our 100th birthday, the university is, and we have Bhutanese architecture, and so there's a lot of stuff going on for our 100th birthday.
You need to ask somebody there in one of the organizations. They'll send me an email. We'll see if we can help them out. We get around 15 or 20 emails a year, and we do around 8 to 10 projects.
You mentioned that you went to the Poe House and the Thurber House. I'm wondering, because of the title of the book, did you go to Springfield?
I did go to Springfield. We actually did a History Matters event there a couple of years ago, and I was when I began the research on the Lincoln myth. Yes, I was there. We did the Lincoln Log Cabin in Southern Illinois. And I began to, that was when this novel began to germinate in my brain, to start putting it together.
A lot of people like ebooks and they like audiobooks. Is your book available for a Kindle an audiobook?
Yeah, we're in every format, audio, download, CDs, large print, hardcover. Paperback will be out later this year. So we're in all formats and in all stores.
And is Mr. Brick still your narrator?
Yeah, Scott Brick does my narrating, and I chose him, and he does great. I love.
He's very good. He's very good.
I love it a lot.
Well, Steve, we want to thank you very much, and we want to let the people know that you are on the New York Times bestselling list and Cotton Malone Adventures. You have 4 standalone thrillers and 4 short story originals, but your books have been printed in more than 51 countries, 40 languages, 17 million books, and we're an NPR affiliate. So a recent NPR survey named The Templar Legacy, which is a great book, one of the top 100 thrillers ever written.
I know, that was really cool to get that on.
And also in 2012, your devotion to historic preservation was recognized by the American Library Association, and you were named the first spokesman for the National Preservation Week, something that was changed in 2013. But congratulations on your work, and thank you very much for joining us, Steve.
Oh, it's great to be here. Appreciate it.
We've been visiting with Steve Berry. He is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Lincoln Myth, and it's a very interesting book. Steve takes a lot of historical things that actually happened, and he mixes them in with present-day times, and I think once you start picking up one of his books, if you have not read any of his books, you're going to have a hard time putting it down. But as Steve mentioned, it's available in all formats, and you can also go to
steveberry.org.
SteveBerry.org, and then click on the History Matters project, and you can find out a little bit more about that. Steve, again, thank you very much for being with us here.
Great to be here.
For more in-depth conversations with best-selling authors like Jim Vornado, Dr. Carl Hart, Dr. Rona Epstein, Nellie Hartnett, and others, visit KTEP.org and mouse through the vast archives of perspectives. Like us on Facebook so you stay up to date for upcoming conversations during the KTEP Summer Book Club. And if you have a suggestion for an author that you would like Louis Sines to talk to, drop us a note on Facebook or contact us through KTEP.org.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.